Nehemiah's vision for change under this series title Rebuild, and the word comes up again and again, and it will come up a lot today in our reading. Rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and the gates that had been burned with fire. They were in great disgrace, weren't they? The exiles had returned, and God was about to relaunch Israel's fortunes, and he used this man and his vision and his confidence, interestingly, not only in himself or even in his own team, but in his God. The God of heaven will give us success, he said last week as we read in Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah was all about God and what God can do when people take him seriously. It doesn't matter how far things have gone, things can improve if we trust in God. We've seen the cry of a desperate heart, a man who was gripped by the problems, and he brought them over, we believe, at least a period of 4 months to God in weeping. Maybe some of you will shed tears this week. In fasting, that sense of denial and determination to show God he was serious. And of course in prayer, to show God the cry of his heart. And chapter 1 really stirred up in Nehemiah the vision that went on to channel the rest of the book. And last week, we took that a stage further, didn't we? From the cry of a desperate heart, we saw that we need the preparation of a diligent servant. It's no good just to talk about or even cry about the problems. We need to go and do some work, to invest in this situation, to look around, to do some investigating and prepare ourselves for what lies ahead. And Nehemiah did that, didn't he? Over a series of evenings, he rode out alone to see just the extent of the problem there in Jerusalem. And this week, we move a step further into chapter 3, and I've called this week The Importance of a Dedicated Team. Nehemiah starts. He's the one who gets before God. Then he goes into the situation with that mandate from God. And at this point, he calls others to help alongside. The importance of a dedicated team. We shall see today, I hope, that it's crucial, not just for the rebuilding of Jerusalem, but for any team, including, as we've been thinking, Sladebrook Evangelical Church. That's something that we need to apply to ourselves. We're not going to read the whole of this chapter. We're going to come across this problem again with lists of names, but they're there for a reason, so I would suggest, if you want to, go away and study them at length for yourself. Names and geography and details are really important. They're there for a reason. But for the public reading this morning, we're going to read the first 12 verses. Bees are amazing creatures. I've been doing a lot of strange things this week, including trying to fix my car. The subject rebuild is not funny at the moment. It wasn't exactly in ruins on Thursday, but if you want to find out more, I'll tell you later. But amidst all this variety, this week I've done a little bit of research into bees, and they really are amazing creatures. Bees have 6 legs, they have 2 eyes, 2 wings, and a nectar pouch, and a stomach. And that's quite interesting. Didn't know that about bees. The only insect that produces fruit, or food I suppose we'd call it, eaten by man. And we obviously spread that on our toast. This is incredible. The honeybee's wings stroke at about 200 beats per second, or almost 11,500 times every minute, thus making their distinctive buzz. Incredible, isn't it? Wow. ADHD in the insect world. A honeybee can fly for up to 6 miles and as fast as 15 miles per hour. Incredible when you think about the size of a bee. Hence, it would have to fly around 90,000 miles, 3 times around the globe, to make 1 pound of honey. Poor bees. The average honeybee will actually only make about 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey in its lifetime. I feel very sorry for our stripy friends, don't you? It takes about 556 workers to gather 1 pound of honey from about 2 million flowers. Wow. A honeybee will visit anything between 50 to 100 flowers during any single collection trip. And a colony of bees consists of 20 to 60,000 honeybees and 1 lady queen. Well, well, well. And I bet she's still in charge, don't you, lads? Anyway, incredible what honeybees are able to do. They also, rather like we've been thinking about sporting teams, can show us something about teamwork. They really can. We've already read some facts that they live in community and they obviously need each other. But listen to this. On a warm day, about half the bees in a hive stay inside, beating their wings. Well, and they beat them very quickly, as we've already heard. While the other half go out to gather pollen and nectar. Because of the beating wings, the temperature inside the hive is about 10 degrees cooler than outside. The bees rotate duties, and the bees that cool the hive one day are honey gatherers the next. That's amazing, isn't it? I never knew that about bees. Bees are quite rock and roll, aren't they? Some celebrities keep bees, don't they? But I think they're rock and roll because just they are. They're amazing. And what an incredible example of teamwork. How the whole thing works, because half do this and half do that, and everyone knows their job and everyone makes a contribution. The importance of a dedicated team in order for you to spread honey on your toast cannot be overemphasized, can it? Everyone has a role and everyone commits to it. This morning we're going to look at the importance, as we've been reading, and the chapter, as I say, goes on to say more about it, the importance of a dedicated team in Nehemiah's challenge to rebuild Jerusalem. The cry of his heart was Nehemiah's. The preparation that he did was pretty much just him alone, with one or two people alongside at different times. But at this point, he needed to invite others to help. And that's really important. Just like the bees, if we're going to get this job done, we need to divide and conquer. So this morning we're going to have a little look at what Nehemiah's team had going for them. And you've got your notes, so you can obviously see what I'm going to say. But we're going to open this up, and then we're going to apply it to ourselves. And then at the end of the morning, as you can see, as a response, hopefully, to what we've thought of, we're going to do something else together. God calls us, as my notes introduce the subject, calls us into community. We're not individuals, we're a body, we're God's people. And at the end, as a response and a celebration of that fact, together we'll remember how that's been made possible as we think about the Lord Jesus and what he's done for us. What did Nehemiah's team have then? Well, there are three things here that I put down that I'd like us just to think about a little bit. We've read a lot of names, a lot of tasks, and a lot of things, but I want just to sort of bring out three things that I think are key in the chapter that we've read together. Nehemiah's team, firstly, had great coordination and cooperation. Great coordination and cooperation. Cast your mind back, if you will, to last week, and Nehemiah, having prayed through the months, having wept before God, having gone to the king, having secured permission to go and taking an entourage from Persia with him, Nehemiah went back to look around, didn't he? And Nehemiah, it was, in my opinion anyway, along with Ezra and, of course, other key official people who you even read about in this chapter, were given the mandate by God, weren't they? Yes, by the king. Artaxerxes released them to go and do it, but really they were given a vision by God under Ezra and Nehemiah. And that vision had gripped him. That vision was something that was so refined in Nehemiah's convictions that he was able to say things about what God had done in his life, and people took it seriously. Remember what we read last week when Nehemiah challenged the officials. You see in verse 17, the trouble we are in, chapter 2. Jerusalem lies in ruins, its gates have been burned with fire. Come and let us rebuild the wall. It's not just going to be like a buckshot, everyone doing a bit of what they want, because Nehemiah has been given a vision. And in verse 18, and I think this is key, he says this: I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. So now Nehemiah has been given a really big kind of vision, hasn't he? A broad brushstroke from God. This is the problem. This is what I need to do. King, will you give me permission? He's given me permission. The wheels are in motion. And the great coordination comes through a great coordinator. Nehemiah is the man who seems to be pivotal to this whole thing. And he's so pivotal that people listen to him. And they actually say, as a response at the end of the same verse, verse 18, well, we better start rebuilding then. So I think it says a lot, doesn't it? It says a lot about them, that they're not prepared just to put hurdles in his way. But it also says a lot about him. This is a leader. This is a man who is iconic. He's going to be a rudder steering things. He's going to be rolling his sleeves up and getting stuck in. He's not doing it from some ivory tower. But he is a coordinator. He's someone who needs to be given the role that God has given him. And they are great cooperators. We've been thinking, haven't we, about how a team works. A goalkeeper needs to talk to his defenders. They need to feed the ball to the midfield. And then the wingers or the strikers hopefully will get into positions to attack the goal. And that's how football works. Can't have one player trying to do everything. We got a boy who on Wednesdays thinks he's Ronaldo. And he's very good, but he's not able to beat teams on his own. And he doesn't pass enough. And he ends up in corners trying to get himself out of trouble that he's got himself into. And so often I hear the cry on Wednesday, pass! And he doesn't. And we're going to have to work on that this year. But the idea here is that the people pass. Let's rebuild. Right, you do that and you do that. Not because they're just drawing ideas out of the air, but because Nehemiah has said, right, this is the problem. This is the situation. Let's rebuild. And everyone else goes, okay, Nehemiah, you fed us the idea. You coordinated it your end. I can see that God is working in your life. We're going to trust your plans and convictions, and we are going to get stuck in. That's the team we read about here. Great coordination and great cooperation. The local church needs both as well, doesn't it? We need to be able to look to leaders, and I feel very challenged by that, who are clear in their convictions, who direct the paths that God has given them or burdened them to promote among the people. And that's something that we have to really wrestle with, and that's not an easy task. And Prayer Week will at one point at least invite you to pray for your leaders. Please do. We need that prayer, don't we? We need coordination from the front. But we also need cooperation from the people. It's no good blaming the leaders or looking to leaders to do everything. You'll end up in the corner with no one to pass to. We need people to say, pass. Give it to me. Let me take that baton. Let me do that thing. We're not looking for clones who just do what we say. But like Nehemiah, we're looking for people that see what God is saying to us and want to get on board with it ourselves. Coordination and cooperation. Any dedicated team needs it. So we have leaders and we have followers. We have workers that together make something happen. And within that group, we have different people and different tasks. That's the other thing that struck me. In some respects, I said to Wendy this week, it's a very easy chapter because it kind of just says one thing. They got on with it and they rebuilt all these gates and things. But on another level, it's quite hard to preach about just for that reason. What on earth can you get out of all these names and gates and so on? Well, I really have meditated a lot, and I was even up quite late last night, I don't mind admitting, just letting the Bible speak to me. And I want you to do the same. The one thing that really struck me about this is that there are different people and tasks. Priests, Levites, perfume makers. Fantastic, isn't it? Imagine if you had a leak in your roof and your local builder wasn't available, but the local perfume maker came round. I wouldn't necessarily trust that, would you? But they got stuck in. Different people. Rulers, daughters. We finished with that verse because I thought it was such a lovely, poignant thing. The family were involved. Goldsmiths, merchants, and what do? Well, they all repaired. The word repair or rebuild comes up a lot in this chapter. They all did the same task, but in different ways. And the gates, and the walls, and the roofs, and even their own houses. It's not in the way that Haggai talks about people building their houses. In the book of Haggai, the prophet comes and he challenges the people. You're too busy building your houses. You've forgotten about God's house. That's not the issue here in Nehemiah. The issue here is that these people were willing to go back to Jerusalem in rubble. They needed places to live. They weren't building up their own empires or feathering their own beds. They just were trying to live and eke out an existence while the work was ongoing. This is a tremendous example of discipleship. People that are willing to work together, people that are willing to do anything it takes, people that are willing to give up home comforts and just simply try and work for the good of God. And I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing that we have this thing. Henry Ford, founder of the great Ford car company. I think I need a Ford, I've had enough of Renaults. But anyway, Henry Ford said this: coming together is a beginning. Keeping together is progress. Working together is success. Working together is success. Different people, different personalities, different generations, different abilities, different demands, but somehow, if we're willing, under good coordination, with willing cooperation to work, then we'll see in all that variety, which is a potential minefield, isn't it? Something harmonious, something that really seems to work. It's a wonderful thing, and it excites me just to read about perfume makers working next to Levites. I think it's great. And we are the same. There are people in this room that do very different things or have had very different career paths, with respect, brought up in different times with different characters, but God has put us all here for a reason. And in the words of Esther, for such a time as this, how do we do that as a community, a dedicated team at Slade Brook? Great coordination and cooperation. Nehemiah's team also had different people and different tasks. And also, to finish this section, Nehemiah's team had no room for politics or pride. All these names, all these things, all this planning and industry that's on. And interestingly, in verse 5, you have probably the low point of the chapter, the one negative, if you like, and there's always one, isn't there, that seems to eke its way in, as if to say, oh, I was enjoying this, and typical, there's something there to challenge us or warn us about what can happen. Nehemiah's team had no room for politics or pride, and this is why. In all these gates and all these walls and all these names of people that are rebuilding them, we read this. The next section, bear in mind we're just going around the walls of a walled city and we're going from place to place, and we'll see a little bit more about that in a minute. The next section of this task was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. Remember, Nehemiah had got permission, didn't he? Official permission, and governors were helping him, and he was getting wood from official sources to rebuild his own house and indeed other buildings. So this was all being done through the right channels. This was a well, as we've said, coordinated project. And yet, even though it was done officially, and even though clearly and tangibly things were being done that were benefiting everyone in the city, the nobles from Tekoa, they simply wouldn't get involved. They would not put their shoulders to the work. And probably the next phrase tells us why, because they didn't want to be told what to do. Under supervision, they were people of dignity, Tekoa had its leaders, and we simply won't be told what to do. Interestingly, it doesn't stop the work, does it? It's almost an aside in what is otherwise a really upbeat and positive chapter. There are many different people, there are many different views, no doubt, going around Jerusalem, many different tasks and personalities doing them, but somehow God is able to harness them under good leadership and willing hearts to get the job done. And these people here, well, they're almost an aside, because in the next verse, the Johanna Gate was being repaired. So the people of Tekoa, they got their job done, but not with the help of their so-called leaders. Their nobles were not prepared to be ordered around. Do you know what? The dedicated team that we read about here has no place for that. It's the only verse and the only incident in the whole chapter, and it doesn't hold up the work. There's no room for this political pride being shown by the Tekoans. The work needs to be done. There's a bigger issue here than you being asked to bow down and roll your sleeves up. And in any dedicated team, you need to see, don't you, the people that are doing this stuff, whatever it takes. You know, I did an FA training course. Church was very kindly let me go for a week up to Culverhay, and I did the course. And we had people come from the FA, including coaches that had done work with Manchester United and Premiership players. And they were talking about the incredible amount of work it takes to produce that kind of winning team. And coaches who literally, you know, they wash boots and they pick people up and they take them to practice and they go through the rain. And there's so many things that aren't glamorous about running a local football team, let alone a Premiership one. It takes even more industry to keep an 80,000-seater stadium in good order. You need your caretakers. You need your cleaners. You need all sorts of people that are willing to just get involved. There's no place for pride. When I came across the dung gate, which we didn't read about in verse 14, you can speculate as to why it was so named. In fact, the gates do have quite a lot of interesting points to make, spiritually as well as historically. Have a look at the gates of the city and you'll see some interesting things. The dung gate probably needs very little explanation. But look at verse 14. It was repaired by a man whose name is very hard to say, but Malchijah, son of Rechab, he rebuilt it. He put its doors and bars back in place. He didn't say, no, I want to do the sheep gate, or no, I want to go up one of the towers and put a roof on up there with a perfume maker. He didn't say that, did he? He said, I'll do it. Show me the dung gate, I'll get on with it. And it was done. And it wasn't done as a single project, it was done as part of the same project. So every person in every role had the same part to play. No room for people that say, oh, I'm not going to do that. A dedicated team does what it takes. And that is a fact. Someone has said, it's amazing how much you can accomplish when it doesn't matter who gets the credit. It's amazing how much you can accomplish when it doesn't matter who gets the credit. The nobles of Tekoa, look at our friend Malchijah, son of Rechab. He's out there building the dung gate, and you can't even raise a finger. No room for that in a team of dedication. So, it's a chapter which is fairly monotonous in one way, fairly basic in one way, but it's profound, isn't it? Because we see in this chapter a dedicated team, great coordination. Nehemiah, you've shown us the way. You're the leader who's clearly telling us what it's going to look like. We're going to cooperate. We're going to be the people of God. And different people and different tasks somehow were able to make this work because God is in it. And he, as we've already read in chapter 2, will grant us success in verse 20. And there's no room for pride. And there's no room for politics. Don't start on about that stuff again. Just either get on with the work or get out of the way, because someone else will do it. That's a dedicated team, and that's what got the work harnessed in Jerusalem in Nehemiah chapter 3. So, Nehemiah's vision for change. I trust that every one of us has a vision for change. We might not be people that have great visions. We might not feel we've ever been spoken to, or God has laid a heavy impression or burden upon our hearts. We might even read chapters like this and they might leave us a little bit tepid if we're honest. We're not that kind of people. But we should be. For any one of us who's following Jesus Christ should have a vision to change our own lives to be more like him, to change our neighbourhoods so that we tell them about him, to change our churches so that we give him more of ourselves and thus glorify our Father in heaven. Every Christian in this room, you should have a vision for change. And it's the cry of a desperate heart, it's the preparation, as we saw last week, of a diligent servant. And this morning I just want to say three things about how our vision for change is dependent on the importance of a dedicated team. And here they are. Excuse me. I said last night I was up very late, and I wasn't up late just scrambling to finish this. I was up late trying to make sense of what I humbly say God was saying to me. And it's a difficult chapter, as I say, and if you've read it, you'll see that there's a lot of very samey language and things going on. All of it good, but quite difficult in some ways to preach about. Three words, or three phrases, kept coming up and kept speaking to me. Whether they speak to you is between you and the Lord, but three things. And the first one was the word repairs. You read it again and again. You read about repairs, you read about rebuilding in this chapter over and again. And it really struck me. Repairs. And I thought, I can't just say that this morning. I need to say something that makes a bit more sense. I might be a bit lateral for some of you. So this is what I really feel repairs speak to me about in Nehemiah 3. It's really about how we must decide to start again. We must decide to start again. There was so much mess, so many ruins, so many things that weren't going anywhere in Jerusalem because they've been razed to the ground. We will no longer be in disgrace, said Nehemiah, if we rebuild, but we currently are. And in God's eyes, that should mean something to us. In verse 13, the valley gate, just as an example, it's not a particularly significant verse, the valley gate was repaired by Hanun and the residents of Zenoa. They rebuilt it and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. They also mended or mended 500 yards of the wall, it says. It's gone off the edge, or I've left it out. But they played their part in rebuilding doors and walls and bolts. And I think that's interesting, because again and again you find groups of people like this doing the job, repairing the ruins. And they had to make a decision. We could either leave this as it is. We could either try and just kind of build this up and sort of prop it up, or maybe just try and eke out an existence in these ruins in Jerusalem, or we can decide to start over. Now I feel for us here at Sladebrook, this is a real challenge. It's a real challenge. It's a real challenge because the temptation and the easy thing to do, and I speak as someone who's employed, and I think some of the wording in my contract talks about change and bringing change and trying to represent change in changing times. We need to, don't we? But it's a temptation in all of us, isn't it, to just try and make good what we've got. And if things don't quite work that well, then we blame other things, other people. They're not interested anymore. They don't want to come back to Jerusalem and live in the ruins. Well, why would they? Why do people want to live in ruins? We're spiritualizing the point, I know, but the point is clear for me. Repairs really challenges us as a church about the decision. We have to decide, friends. Are we going to rebuild, or are we just going to let things carry on? Some things are new. Some things are innovative. They're fresh. And know that Jerusalem didn't look quite like it did before the exile. But some things obviously were clearly just remade. The Dung Gate we've mentioned, the Valley Gate, the Fish Gate. These were iconic points that needed attention if Jerusalem was ever to rediscover its old pomp and reputation. And so the people had to think, right, we just can't leave it like this. We have to start over. And in a church, friends, there are times where we need to make that choice. And it's a hard one. Because some things don't go very well. They might have done once, but they don't perhaps now. And I think that's a real challenge. Things that perhaps we bemoan, yes, where are people, where's the help, where's the commitment, we say. Well, maybe we need to go back to our first point. In order to get cooperation, we need to have good coordination. We need to look at the thing and think, well, is this even working anymore? And if it's not, We need to be like these men and women and daughters and goldsmiths and say, right, let me get on with the job. I'll repair it. Let's start again and redefine the thing completely. And I found that very challenging this week, because the temptation on us all, isn't it, is to try and sort of just collect up the bits and keep going, rather than say, right, we need to remove these and build fresh foundations. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 9, neither do men pour new wine into old wineskins. He's talking about the new thing that he's bringing in, the age of the Holy Spirit that will come as a result of his ascension and the Spirit of God coming to dwell in men and the gospel message becoming a reality in our world. Judaism, that's passing. It's old, it's crusty. It can't contain what God's doing. It's actively opposing it, like the nobles of Tekoa did. Jesus said if they do that, the skins will burst and the wine will run out and the wineskins will be ruined. Sometimes there's a need for something new. Sometimes there's a need to say the old, well, we need to get rid of that now because it's broken. It did a great job. Jerusalem was a powerful city, wasn't it, prior to it being sacked by the Babylonians. But we need to rebuild it. And it's God's name that's on the line. We're in disgrace. So let's make a decision as a church. Let's make a decision as a community that where we need to be brave enough to look at the things we do and say, well, that's just not working, let's be prepared to rebuild it. That takes faith, doesn't it? That takes cooperation. That takes prayer. And I would suggest feedback from Prayer Week would be a great time for us to talk about how perhaps we do that as a community. Not doing things just because we've always done them, but because we know we should. And currently they're just not good enough. You might allow your prayers to guide you into what you think that might be in Prayer Week. Things that we perhaps need attention to give attention to. Things that need rebuild. We must decide, friends, to start over when necessary. It's a hard truth, but it's a wonderful one, because God has granted us success. And Jesus says, I will build my church. There's the echo of Jesus' promise in the promise of Nehemiah in chapter 2, isn't it? We will get success, verse 20. God will give it to us, because ultimately it's his work. The second word that came up for me this week was the word doors. And it's mentioned a few times in the chapter. We must be willing to start over, friends, and we must be able to face the situation honestly and maybe drastically in order to rebuild for God's glory. But it's one thing to say it. It's another thing to do it. You see, what really struck me in this chapter about the doors was this. Look at verse 1. Eliashib, the first chap mentioned, he's the high priest, no less. And his fellow priests, they go to work with him. And he rebuilt the sheep gate, which I've spelt wrong. I told you I was up late. They dedicated it and they set its doors in place. And if you go down the chapter, look at verse 3, the fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hassanah. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Happens again and again. Doors within doors. It's a different culture. But nonetheless, these are important things. They're also finished things. They're also works that have been taken up and completed. Eliashib the high priest and his fellow priests went to work. Do you know, some people go to work, but then they drift off. They know that we need to rebuild. They talk all the time about change and the way we need to get this fresh vision. But do you know what? When the bolts are finally put in place, and when the doors are finally sealed, they're nowhere to be seen. Eliashib saw the job through. And when the door is shut, a bit like at the end of a long Wednesday perhaps, after toddlers or after ask, when that door is finally shut, it's quite a nice feeling. But it's at the end of a lot of jolly hard work. And I think there's mighty symbolism here. The door was finished. The door was dedicated. The door was bolted. The door was done. And we must commit, friends, until it's done. It's no good talking about what Sladebrook lacks. It's no good talking about the things that we don't do. It's no good saying, oh, well, we could be a dedicated team, but it's really about you, isn't it? It's not about the person next. It's about you and me being prepared to see a job through. There are people here in this church, and they would appreciate being named, so I won't name them. But do you know what? There are things that get done in this church that some of you probably don't even know about. But they see it through. They close the gates. They dedicate the work. They lock those bolts. And God sees their efforts. Some of you are hankering to see great things happen. Great! I don't blame you. I'm one of them. But it won't happen unless we go to work, rebuild, dedicate it, and finally seal God's approval on it. So what are you doing? How dedicated are you to this team? We need you. Is there a job? The old hymn says, there's a work for Jesus none but you can do. I can't do it. God knows what it is. And maybe even prayer week will give you a fresh burden. Paul says in 1 Timothy 4 that Demas left me because he loved this world. Didn't have enough time for Paul. Didn't have enough time for the gospel. Just a half measure. He went to work, but he didn't shut the door. And Paul was deserted. Don't start something. Don't say you're going to start something and then leave halfway through. Finish that work. Shut that door. And God will open another one. Because we're called to work until we're called home. But that was, it's such a good feeling. It's tiring, disappointing, excruciating thing. But you know what? If we're serving God, then the day that that door is shut, you know you've committed and you've done a good job. And Eliashib shows us the way. We must commit until it's done. And the last thing. Repairs kept coming up in my mind, and doors kept coming up in my mind. And the last thing is houses. Houses. Do you know the phrase, next to him, comes up 20 times in this chapter. There's a tremendous teamwork. And next to him was this person, and over there it actually says beyond them. You know, there's this sense almost that you can look up and wave, and you were doing your bit, and they were doing their bit. Tremendous sense of God using this team next to him. Jediah made repairs opposite his house, and Hattish next to him. That's just an example of what I'm trying to say. All these people in their neighbourhoods working together and working, incidentally, very often by their house. What do I mean by this? Well, the thing that struck me, and I really thought about this, and I prayed about it, and I felt a tremendous burden come over me. Yes, we need commitment, friends. Yes, we need to rebuild, friends. But do you know what? We also need to be realistic. We also need to be compassionate to the needs of people. Do you remember when Nehemiah went to the king? He said, look, I'm going to need permission to get wood, because I'm going to need somewhere to live. Nehemiah wasn't a robot. He wasn't just trying to rebuild some concept. He wanted to rebuild his own life. My father's tombs are there, he said, didn't he, in chapter 1, in chapter 2. That's why he was so sad. His whole heritage was at stake. And yes, he was prepared to commit, but he also deserved to live. And I feel very strongly that very often the last place we get to work is near to our homes. Near to our families. There's not a realism about some of the demands of Christian ministry. I go to ministry training on a Thursday and recently had a frightening statistic. Out of every 10 men in their 20s that go into ministry, only one will retire in his 60s in the same role. The burnout rate is phenomenal. And some of you are doing that job on top of a full-time job. It's actually my job, and I feel burnt out. So how some of you must feel, I have no idea. Houses. Being able to work within a stone's throw. Realistic about what I can do. I can do something, and I meant to do something, but don't ask me to go up to the Valley Gate, because I live over there by the Dung Gate. It's where the property was cheapest, but... But be realistic. Okay, well, I'll work here then. I'll work near my home. I'll do something and it's going to be actually achievable and realistic. And my wife won't not see me every night of the week. And my kids won't forget what I look like at the end of the month. Because actually, I can work for God and still be close enough to go home. Tell me if I'm stretching the point. I don't think so. These are people that worked where they could, how they could. And they weren't asked to do beyond the pale, were they? They did what they could, where they could. We must learn, friends, to share in the task of ministry. Don't just leave it for those who you know have always done it. There's a leak in the toilet, you know it'll get done. But why should that person have to leave their home when you never leave yours? Houses are important in Nehemiah chapter 3. And I would suggest houses or homes are very important to God. And he wants us to spend time together and have as much time to rest and enjoy our loved ones as to get involved at the rock face. Sometimes the two can be closer than you think. Don't overstretch the people that are already at capacity. Jesus said, "My yoke is easy. And my burden is light." I don't know how many of us actually, if we're honest, experience that. I don't say that irreverently. Of course, we know what Jesus means by that. He doesn't load us with the demands that the world does or religion does. Grace is a wonderful freeing thing. But the church can at times become a very hard taskmaster, can't it? And we're meant to enjoy Christian service. Homes and houses and loved ones and daughters, they're all involved, yes, but they're all doing what they can. They're not being expected to do more. We must share this task, friends, unless you want to see some go under. Get involved. Don't ask to do more than you can do, but do what you can do so that we can all enjoy our families and our homes and our Christian lives. That's the importance, I think, of a dedicated team, and there's much more in there. But this morning, I hope God is calling you. We're meant to rebuild. We have a vision for change. God will grant us success. We need to say, let's get on with it and see what God does. Amen.